Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. The wind is accompanying me today as I record. Today we're going to be listening to a recent episode of Desert Oracle Radio, but first, let's catch up. I hope you enjoyed a good Independence Day. Out where I live, it was quiet for the holiday. Maybe people were attending big celebrations in Bozeman or Livingston. The last days of June, I was camping up by Red Lodge. By my second morning, the rains had pretty much backed off, and Rock Creek was so beautiful, running high, and those rushing waters sound a lot like hard rain when you get up close. It's a beautiful part of Montana. The first day of July, I attended a bug hike sponsored by Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness Foundation. I hope we hear from Patrick Cross of that organization in a future episode. I was in my element as I strolled along a sunny trail with about 12 other bug fans. The expert in the group was Marion L. Kirst from the Montana Moth Project. It's amazing to see the variety of bugs that live in even a small portion of grasses. I fell in love with jumping spiders all over again, and now I'm looking more closely at the blooms and foliage of the plants that grow near my house. Marion is a great educator, and I hope we can hear from her in a future episode, too. Here's something I learned. Butterflies are not that great at pollinating, but flies, bees, and moths are champions. Of course, all these critters are vital parts of the ecology of our region, so keep thinking about this as you plan your flower or native plant gardens. Here are some events where you can keep learning about our local environment. Friday, July 14th, there's a Crail Ranch garden tour and hike at Big Sky at 1 p.m. Top off your visit to the Big Sky Wildflower Festival with a tour of the Crail Gardens located at the historic Crail Ranch. Built in 2019, the gardens use native plants that are wildlife-friendly, water-wise, and sensitive to the historic landscape. The garden tour will be followed by a guided hike to view blooming plants in the meadow and surrounding forests. You'll hike at plant identification base for about 1.5 miles, but folks are welcome to continue on and enjoy the full 4-mile loop if they like. This event is part of the Big Sky Wildflower Festival that runs July 10th through the 14th, with a variety of free and fun events and educational workshops throughout the week. Full details can be found on the events page of www.gallatinisa.org, and that's all one word, GALLATINISA.org. Crail Gardens is located at 2100 Spotted Elk Road, Big Sky. Contact the leader, Jen Mahler, of the Gallatin Invasive Species Alliance for more information. And her email is jen@gallatinisa.org or 406-209-0905. And in late July, you can join Sacagawea Audubon Society for an evening tour of lovely gardens in a downtown Bozeman neighborhood. This is the bird-friendly garden tour, and it's going to be on July 28th at 6:30 p.m. This inspiring tour includes 2 in-town yards that have been designed to attract birds, pollinators, and other wildlife, as well as create inviting outdoor living spaces. Jennifer Magic has a layered landscape of trees and berry-producing shrubs for bird habitat and lush gardens of perennials for insects and pollinators. You'll also visit the nearby gardens of Amy Sticks, who eliminated all mowed lawn in her front yard and now has a welcoming landscape of perennials, grasses, and shrubs. The plants she chose attract birds and pollinators, supporting biodiversity right in the heart of Bozeman. This tour has a 15-person limit, and registration is required. Contact either Vicki Saab, and that's Vicki Saab, S-A-A-B, at SacagaweaAudubon.org, or Paulette Eppel, conservation@SacagaweaAudubon.org, to register and get directions. Well, I think it's time for our Desert Oracle Radio episode. This episode was produced by Ken Lane on July 7th, 2023, and it's about hidden things. Ken is interviewing the author of a soon-to-be-released book called Under the Eye of Power. Enjoy!
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. Tonight we are talking about hidden things, secret societies, conspiracies. Joining us by telephone from New York is the author Colin Dickey, who has written interesting books about a lot of our favorite topics: ghosts, flying saucers, and especially the many reasons so many of us are drawn to the supernatural, the occult, the paranormal. His latest, in stores next week from Viking Books, is called Under the Eye of Power: How Fear of Secret Societies Shapes American Democracy. Colin Dickey, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. This is great.
I'm excited about this book. I love the secret histories of American politics and the revolution and the stories about the French setting it all up as... I'm not sure what the reason was, but there was some reason that you probably are going to answer in this book. What made you turn to this subject after doing the Ghostland book and Unidentified?
Right, yeah. So after Ghostland, I had this idea. I wanted to do a book about conspiracy theories and also cryptids like Bigfoot. And UFOs, which ties into conspiracy theories. And I started writing this really kind of wild, freewheeling book about conspiracy theories of all manner. And then at some point, I decided that all I really wanted to do was write about Bigfoot and UFOs. And so I kind of cut two-thirds of that book just out and just left it on the ground and wrote what ended up being my last book, The Unidentified, which is sort of about our obsession with strange creatures and flying saucers and the lost continent of Atlantis. So I had all this material about these sort of weird conspiracy theories and I wasn't sure what to do with it. And at some point it sort of clicked to me that a kind of through line through all of them was this idea about the, you know, particularly these secret groups that are kind of working behind the scenes to influence our thought and our actions and our behavior, and how we kind of keep coming back to those time and time again, whether or not they're Freemasons or the Illuminati or in kind of more kind of racist ways, you know, the Jews or the Catholics, and then sort of more recently, you know, Satanists and lizard people from outer space. And I got kind of very interested in this idea of why we as a culture kind of keep coming back to imagining that there's this kind of secret cabal out there which is pulling the strings and telling us how to think and how to behave and how to believe and how we have to sort of fight back from this nefarious group of hidden actors.
My assumption with conspiracy theories is that there's always truth in them. Anything to do with wars, assassinations, justification for invasions and occupations, anything involving billions or trillions of dollars, there are always people in power who are manipulating the narrative, and it's a profession. Like the story about Saddam's troops yanking the premature babies out of the incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital, which was one of the main points to drum up outrage for the first Gulf War. I remember watching that. It came with he's worse than Hitler and et cetera. And today it's known as a Kuwaiti incubator hoax, and it was one of many pieces of the U.S. government's conspiracy to mislead Americans into supporting that war. That happened again with George Bush Jr.'s administration when the second Iraq war was falsely justified. So there's real conspiracies with real conspirators in powerful positions, and the Washington media being part of that same social and economic circle, they nearly always repeat the propaganda word for word until years and years later when the truth comes out, which is a point that you make right at the beginning of your book that I thought was great. This was the part, I think, on page 5. Do you mind reading that?
Yeah, sure. Of course, there are conspiracy theories, and then there are actual conspiracies. On the surface, it may sound to someone unfamiliar with American history that there's little difference between alleging the Ku Klux Klan was behind JFK's assassination and arguing that the most powerful man in the United States was behind a bumbling, idiotic break-in at the Watergate Hotel. The difference is that over time, one of these theories was repeatedly and thoroughly confirmed, while the other was not. Accordingly, while nearly all conspiracy theories have a degree of plausibility, and many contain at least some small kernel of truth, history suggests that genuine conspiracies have a tendency to unravel almost as soon as someone goes looking into them. Whistleblowers, deathbed confessions, sworn depositions, petty vengeance, any number of basic human motivations will undermine an act of conspiracy. And the larger a conspiracy supposedly is, the more actors it will require to be successful, which in turn demands a larger and larger sphere of absolute secrecy for the conspirators to remain undetected. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein learned a great deal about Watergate from secretaries and other low-level office workers, people integral to the implementation of Nixon's schemes, but who lacks the ideological dedication of his higher-ups.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It sets the table in a way that's very clear.
Right. And I think your point about the Bush era, which is something I get into in the later chapters of my book, is a really important one, in the sense that the difference I would argue between a kind of like an actual conspiracy and a conspiracy theory is that one of the things about conspiracy theories is they are imagined as completely totalizing and also 100% successful. So when you talk to conspiracy theorists about whatever it is, that quote unquote the Jews control the media or whatever, something like that, the idea is that the people who are in on it have this very specific plan that they are able to implement flawlessly and without detection, and anything that appears to be sort of against the plan is in fact sort of misdirection or a false flag or something like that. When you look at the second invasion of Iraq, Bush Jr., these are the most powerful men in the country. They had at their disposal the greatest military known to human history and, this massive government apparatus. They had the collusion of the media, as you suggest, that you sort of were active dupes in this process. And they screwed it up, like Iraq was a quagmire. The whole idea was a conspiracy so that Cheney and his friends could get easy access to Iraqi oil in perpetuity. And instead, what they got was a mess. And I think that's a sort of difference between the way actual conspiracies work, which, even with the, best, by which I mean worst, intentions, they go haywire because history is full of chaos and unexpected developments and just sort of randomness. Whereas a conspiracy theory is always kind of imagined to be perfectly successful in all of its implementation.
A narrative, a sort of super narrative that can involve Anything. And you mentioned Kennedy in that part that you just read. The U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1979, they did conclude that he was assassinated as the result of a conspiracy. And they even went with the Grassy Knoll second shooter as the official conclusion, although they didn't name anyone and they made sure to say the CIA and et cetera had nothing to do with it. That we can tell you. And then last week, the Biden administration, like the Trump administration before, suppresses the release of what should be public information about that assassination 60 years ago in November. I mean, how can that not keep the most complex conspiracy theory alive when you do see actual examples like that?
Right. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that I did when I started out this book, I mentioned I started with your usual suspects, with the Freemasons and the Illuminati and the Satanic Panic of the 1980s. And I was sort of trying to figure out a kind of grouping that would sort of make sense of the scope of the book. And I kind of hit upon this basic formulation that I was looking at a group of conspirators acting in secret, either fictitious or real, in an attempt to undermine American democracy or break American laws. And that was kind of what I decided was going to be the focus of the book. And as soon as I kind of had that as my formulation of, you know, as meant the Freemasons or the Jews or hidden Satanists of the 1980s, but it also became very quickly apparent to me that that definition would also fit the FBI and the CIA, who way more so than these supposedly media controlling Jews or whatever, are the actual people who worked in secret in a coordinated effort to undermine American civil liberties, break American laws, and harm American citizens. And, you know, we got that with the COINTELPRO break-in. You know, we got that with the Church Committee. So we, you know, we have sort of documentary evidence of that. And they are perhaps the best example of this thing that I think most Americans, particularly on the right, although they kind of don't want to admit it, are most terrified of. So I think you're right that they kind of bear out the worst hallucinations of the sort of conspiracy theorist mind, while often not even being sort of recognized as being the kind of thing that conspiracy theorists are kind of most exercised about.
When I was growing up in New Orleans, we had fantastic radio stations of all kinds, you know, soul, and the pop stations were terrific. And there was a call-in show, I remember, on a black talk news station, a community station. The show had a black host who had a very deep, wonderful voice. Everything sounded deep and sinister when he was talking about it. And all these callers from the city, and I'd listen late at night. It's where I first heard about Thomas Jefferson fathering all these children with the enslaved women that he kept, and the Nazi mad scientists, Tuskegee's syphilis experiment on hundreds of poor black men, 40 years that went on, and J. Edgar Hoover recording Martin Luther King Jr. having sex. All this stuff that you didn't hear anywhere else at the time, in the 1970s, early 70s. And then over time, all these conspiracy theories were proven true. And so that in particular taught me, pay attention to the conspiracy theories coming out of the black community, because they're so far ahead of official truth. And it really backs up this idea that the official story is fake and it's to keep people oppressed. So I just got your book manuscript this morning, so I've skimmed more than I've read. But I was glad to see a number of references to conspiracies against black people in particular in your book, and how secret societies are sometimes used by oppressed and marginalized communities as a sort of taking back of control of their lives. And I'm wondering how you see these traditions of often real conspiracies in oppressed communities, which would also include gay men with AIDS in the early 1980s, or immigrant communities throughout the centuries, the Irish, the Sicilians, etc.
So there's a great folklorist, I think she's at UCLA, and I cite her in the book a couple of times. Her name is Patricia Turner, who writes about urban legends in the Black community that I found really helpful. And you're right, you're absolutely right that in many cases, things that seemed absolutely fantastical, absolutely beyond belief, turned out to be very true, whether Tuskegee or the revelations about Martin Luther King or the assassination of Fred Hampton, you know, all those things. But one of the other things that Patricia Turner writes about is things that have been very prevalent in Black communities, but also are not true, that Church's Chicken had a sterilizing agent that was specifically targeted to go after young Black men in the Black population. So, you know, and I think she's very good, and I hope I was able to do her justice in sort of, you know, citing her, bringing her into my own book, but of kind of parsing, there are conspiracies that turn out to be literally true. There are conspiracy theories that are literally false, but nevertheless offer a kind of narrative and articulation and a way of making sense of other things that may be sort of more nebulous and more kind of harder to put your finger on. Alleging that the KKK secretly owns the tobacco companies, and again, is using tobacco as a means of poisoning and disenfranchising the Black community, that is not literally true, but that is a narrative that offers a kind of good and evil scheme to make sense of the way that tobacco companies are sort of simply rapacious capitalists who are happy to take money however they can get it without any regard for their consumer. A lot of the way the conspiracy theories kind of take root and flower is because they offer a simplified good and evil narrative that makes sense of a chaotic and random world. And the guy who actually coins the term conspiracy theory, Karl Popper, has this great quote, which I use as an epigraph for the book, which is, "The conspiracy theory of society happens when you get rid of God and ask, what is in his place?" To go back to that earlier conversation we were having about the Bush administration versus the Illuminati, the idea that the Illuminati are perfectly capable of enacting their nefarious schemes and everything that happens as part of this hidden but perfectly realized plan, that is not an understanding of history so much as, on some level, kind of theological perspective, a belief that there is such a thing as sort of perfect causality, which most modern historians will tell you just does not exist and isn't true. But a conspiracy theorist, which is different from somebody, I think, who understands that there are actual conspiracies and these are worth ferreting out and investigating and unearthing. But a conspiracy theorist, I think, is someone for whom the allure is the idea of the perfectly enacted scheme and the idea that even if it's malevolent, it's still basically a theology.
Right, right. It's part of God's plan. It's as God wills it.
Exactly,
And God works in mysterious ways, so it doesn't always make sense, but there's a plan behind it all. What is a real secret society that you write about here that a non-powerful group has used for interesting purposes?
One of the most, again, when I sort of made my taxonomy, one of the things that I was kind of really interested to realize sort of fit the scheme and was really fascinating with exploring was the Underground Railroad. Again, this is a network group that were working in secret in order to break American laws, in this case, the Fugitive Slave Law. And I think of that as, I was really excited to sort of put that in the book as a way of sort of kind of complicating this idea that secret societies are these nefarious, that breaking American laws is always unjust. I think of that as an example of kind of complicating this idea that when we think about secret societies, that they're always sort of fictitious and nebulous and, you know, and malevolent.
That is a group that is rarely included in our typical list of American secret societies, and one that probably had one of the most real-world impacts.
Again, one of the things that was also really fascinating about that is that it was nowhere near as organized, I think, as either its proponents nor its detractors like to make it out to be. You know, the proponents wanted to sort of present this as this far-reaching thing to sort of prove that the public and, you know, everybody was behind them, whereas the slave owners in the South wanted to present it as this big, far-reaching, tentacles everywhere conspiracy that was doing great harm, when in fact, the logistics of being a secret society meant that there was limits, and rather than being this super secretly, coherently organized thing, the Underground Railroad, in fact, was a lot more ad hoc, often provisional, people not necessarily communicating, you know, in sort of large groups for safety and security reasons, and much more spontaneous and decentralized than I think it gets portrayed.
A couple of years back, I'm not sure how long it was now, you drove out to Joshua Tree and we talked about UFOs for your previous book, The Unidentified, pre-pandemic. Speaking of things that generate conspiracy theories, before the big reset of our lives, before every retail strip became a ghost town and people became permanent shut-ins. Do you remember that trip out here?
Oh, I do. That was one of my favorite interviews for that book. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Did we hike? We hiked, I think.
We hiked, yeah. Yeah, we hiked and with your dog, as I remember.
Yeah.
It was dusk. It was beautiful. It was a great time.
That book has, I can't remember now if the map is in the book or was with the promotional materials, but there was this great map of the United States with these map icons of monsters and flying saucers. And I remember looking at that and thinking that would be the Great American Road Trip.
Oh, yeah. Well, and what I did, I have a friend named Jason Brown, who I got a lot of my thinking about UFOs originally through him. He gives talks. He used to in the pre-pandemic. He used to give talks in this basement in Chinatown in L.A. He doesn't write very much, so I couldn't really quote him. And so what I did instead is I took him on a road trip, not when I went out of Joshua Tree, but on a separate trip. We drove through Area 51 and out to Socorro, New Mexico, and had a great time just going through the, you know, acid Southwest and hitting some of the sort of great landmarks of American military weirdness and UFO conspiracies. That was a great trip.
Oh, that sounds so much fun. That's the only summer vacation I want to take. You've written books about the classic esoteric and paranormal subjects now, so it's clearly part of you. It's in your blood. So I always ask people, and I'm especially interested in asking you, what sort of personal experiences have you had? What's the weirdest thing, the thing you can't explain away? And as part of that, do you feel a need to explain away the bizarre, the paranormal? Or are there things you accept as real in the sense that it really happened to you, subjectively at least, however it might have occurred?
One of the things I tried to do with the Unidentified was really, as much as I was trying to explain why we believe things and maybe some of the reasons why we shouldn't, I wanted to keep an open mind. I really wanted that book to end on a note of saying there is still a possibility of the unknown and there's still a possibility of wonder out there in the world. And I think by the end of that book, I'd run so many different UFO stories and cryptid stories to the ground, and there were a handful that I just couldn't come up with a good explanation for. The Socorro, New Mexico UFO sighting being one of them. The incident in Lawndale, Illinois in 1977 when two birds that were described as closest to being a California condors picked up a small six-year-old child in a backyard in suburban Illinois. And the other one is the Great Kentucky Meat Shower of 1876 when meat fell from the sky over Olympia Springs, Kentucky. And I went out to Lexington, I think it's Lexington, to Transylvania University to see the last remaining chunk of Kentucky sky meat, which is in a jar in a university out there. And so there are things that I don't have scientific explanations for, things that I still find really sort of baffling and strange.
How about anything in your own life?
Yeah, in my own life, that's a little harder. I saw it as close to firsthand. I saw it secondhand, but really struck me was when I got hired by Maxim magazine to go to the Mustang Ranch, the brothel in Reno, Nevada, and profile the owner.
Just outside of Sparks on the river.
Yeah. So the piece got killed. So the piece never ran. But while I was there, and the photographer was setting up a shot with some of the women who worked there, which is sort of killing time and chatting with the madam. And that's, she told me that the Mustang Ranch was haunted. And I was, you know, at the time I was writing Ghostland book on ghosts and stuff. So of course I was totally fascinated. And she told me about one of the girls who had had this experience. And a couple of minutes later, this woman happened to walk by. So she grabbed her. She said, go get your camera. Go show them the video. Right. So she comes back with this video that she shows me. So I obviously wasn't in the room, but I watched the video. And basically, this woman married, her husband lived in Southern California. So when she was working at the Mustang Ranch, she would send him videos. Thankfully, this one was more or less PG-13, because that would have seemed a little too intimate. But she's in this video, and she's just kind of dancing seductively for the camera, right? And there is there's an orb, right? One of these glowing balls, and it's sort of floating around the screen. It's the kind of thing where I think if you were a very rational person, you would just say, oh, it's some sort of weird light thing, or it's a glitch. You know, there are any number of ways you could describe it. But about 40 seconds into this video, which I'm watching, the orb kind of scoots off screen, and you just kind of lose track of it. And then a couple seconds later, it comes like roaring back into the frame. And just at the moment when it hits her temple, in the video, she falls over. She like loses her balance and falls over. And it's really, it was really like strange. Again, like I don't know what it was, you know. And she was like, yeah, I don't know. Like I just fell over. And then when I looked at the video, I saw this thing. And obviously she didn't see it in the room when she was taking the video. So who knows? But it's a thing that I certainly watched that video. That's what I can tell you.
Oh, that's wild. So everybody keep sending your private videos around. Maybe you'll get knocked out by a ghost someday.
Sure. Yeah, that is the takeaway. More spicy videos should be recorded and disseminated in case they have paranormal activity on them.
The new book is called Under the Eye of Power. And tell me the subtitle again. It's so good.
The subtitle is How Fear of Secret Society Shapes American Democracy.
It's out on July 11th. Go to colindickey.com for links to all of his books, or get it at your local bookstore if you're lucky enough to still have one. Colin Dickey, thanks for joining us on Desert Oracle Radio.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been so much fun.
Isaacs and across the great Mojave wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with musical soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And I'm your host, Ken Lane. Most people in our time listen to this show as a podcast, but we are on the air broadcasting on Friday nights at 10 p.m. KCDZ 107.7 on your FM dial in the Mojave High Desert. Our website is desertoracle.com, where you can subscribe to our pocket-sized periodical about the mysterious American desert. Another heat wave on the way, but still cooler than usual in the Mojave Desert. What's the use in crying all the time about the climate if you don't enjoy the weather when it's pleasant? Good night from the voice of the desert.
Speaking of hidden things, have you ever thought about the way insects camouflage themselves at different stages of their life? Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to be one of those insects? Are you a fly fisherman, or do you know someone who does fly fish? Well, here's a reading from Nature, A Day at a Time by Kathy Katz, and it's about caddisfly. Caddisfly larvae are the bagworms of the water. But unlike bagworms, who stay in their protective cases on land their entire lives and never change form, caddisworms undergo complete metamorphosis, leaving the water after about a year to emerge as moth-like insects with fully developed wings. The term caddis came from case flies. Each larva builds a case around itself in which it lives while becoming a mature insect. The cases are made from stones, leaves, twigs, sand, fibers, and any other available marine debris. The larvae have sharp jaws to cut through tough leaves, bark, and grass. Small stones, shells, and discarded pieces are glued on as an artistic flourish. Each species creates its own distinctive case, usually with a style that identifies the artist. One of the most creative is a miniature net built by one species to collect particles of food drifting in the water, similar to the seines used by humans to catch seafood. And there's a quote by Henry David Thoreau, "Each of us has a genius within us waiting to be released." The latest Calcea newsletter from Montana Native Plant Society carries an excellent article about pollinator studies and reminds readers to be on the watch for the western bumblebee. Look for a bumblebee with a white butt. Take a photo if you can and contact Tabitha Graves, and that's tgraves@usgs.gov. I'll spell that for you. tgraves@usgs.gov, and or Erica Gustillo, and that's EGUSTILO @usgs.gov, to help in the research. Of course, there is much more in that newsletter that I'll include in future episodes. And if you write poetry, Elk River Books in Livingston has a clever idea. This is from their newsletter. The poetry dispenser is a paper towel dispenser as seen in your favorite public restroom, except ours has been beautifully painted by Livingston artist Angie Froke of Raised by Wolves Studios and repurposed to dispense free poems to visitors of our bookstore. Selected poems will be printed as broadsides on quality textured paper suitable for framing. Several copies of each poem will be added to the dispenser. People then pull out a sheet and enjoy a bit of poetry. The idea is to make poetry a public and daily celebration. Send 3 to 5 poems, up to 30 lines each, including line breaks, to info@elkriverbooks.com. Previously published poems are accepted and encouraged. Include publications to credit. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246, and it's going to go right to voicemail, so you don't have to talk in person to anyone unless you leave a message to me that you do. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. All of our Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Next week, look for another double feature. That's it for today, so till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. Wow. I don't know about you, but I feel like we covered a lot of topics in this one, even though it was a shorter talking-wise episode. But the subjects, from flowers to insects to bumblebees, caddisflies, and even conspiracies, really have my mind going in a lot of directions. I feel kind of spacey. So I think I'm going to close this one out with some FC Kahuna and Half Dis Hold. And it's an oldie but goodie. You might recognize it. And then I think we're going to throw in some U2. And if we have time, we'll have some Washed Out also. And the next few weeks, I'm not going to be able to really settle into creating these episodes as far as the little nature points and things like that that I normally do. So I'm going to load a lot of back-to-back double feature episodes, and I hope you enjoy that. And I will be back when I'm back with lots of stories. Enjoy. Thank you.
don't cling, don't hoax, don't freak, freak, don't leak, don't speak. Don't connect, protect, don't expect, suggest. Don't project, don't connect.